Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thank you for joining us, a session again on Engaged Society. I'm Mark Paul. I'm a visiting scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley and co-author of the book California Crack Up. And we are here today, this panel, focusing particularly on is a couple of issues, direct democracy and emerging groups in the electorate that are particularly a concern here in California, where we are, in many ways, the exemplar of both changes. And so I'd like to introduce my fellow panelists. Immediately to my right is Daniel Hosang, who is a professor, teaches political science and ethnic studies at the University of Oregon. And then Jane Jun, who you heard her question this morning, is a professor of political science at University of Southern California and director of the USC LA Times poll. Survey and author of three books on voter participation and democracy. So I want to we'll get right into it with Dan and particularly he's written a book about race and the initiative process in California, and we have him talk a little about what California's experience with those subjects means for the broader subject of democracy.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. Thanks for the invitation. I think I just, for about 5 or 6 minutes, I'm going to just kind of share some images and talk a little bit about how Californians' history of racialized direct democracy might be relevant to our discussion today. And as I thought about this, I imagined we could channel our inner Alec Trebek, because it's clear that if we were to project this onto the show Jeopardy, that there's some agreement that the answer clearly is democracy. But then it, of course, raises the point, what is the question? And this could be a fun party game. We could all go around and write what the question is, right? And I'm thinking, it could be, what's the motive force, driving people in the streets of Tripoli? Or, what values undergird, a free market economy? So there's obviously multiple responses to this, but I do want to say that in California, one response to this is, how have Californians historically justified racial inequality? That democracy has been the kind of institutional and rhetorical kind of mode in which racial domination has been justified, and I want to just lay out a little bit of that history. Some people will be familiar with this history. Any of you, in the 1990s, when in a span of 6 years, California voters confronted a series of racialized ballot measures. In 1994, a three-strikes mandatory minimum sentencing measure, which inaugurated what one criminologist called the largest penal expansion project in human history. That was this.
Thank you.
The same year, Proposition 187, making citizenship a condition of all public and private benefits. And just as one thing to remember about Prop 187, it would have required every California college student, community college, Cal State UCs, to every term demonstrate their citizenship. You can imagine 3 million college students lining up each term or be turned over to the INS by rule. Well, in 1996, California became the first state to consider an official ban on all public affirmative action programs in employment and education. 1998, the first state to consider a ban on bilingual education and imposing essentially a one-size-fits-all program on English language learners. In 2000, a measure to try juveniles, some as young as 16 as adults, and increase criminal sentences for juveniles. This is a Democratic electorate. By the end of the decade, Democrats hold all statewide offices, pass liberal measures around minimum wage, medical marijuana, rejecting charter schools. All of these pass, and they pass by a wide majority. Right? Prop 209 is the closest. And I was actually an organizer in the Bay Area during this time and trying to get my head around, as a relatively new Californian, how does a state that's so steeped in notions of multiculturalism, diversity, being at the forefront of kind of human progress, embrace these measures? And I think at the time, many of us thought of this as a departure from a kind of earlier history. And as I began my kind of research into it, I realized it's in fact an extension, an expression of California's use of direct democracy. So in the 1940s and 1946, California voters considered whether to make employment discrimination by unions and employers against the law and to address widespread practice of discrimination. In 1964, California realtors put a measure on the ballot to make racial and religious discrimination in housing a constitutionally protected practice. In 1972 and 79, measures to overturn court-ordered school desegregation orders, and in 1979 in particular, to rewrite the Equal Protection Clause of the state constitution in order to make permissible school segregation. An elegant eight-sentence or nine-word, you know, all people shall have equal protection under the law, modified by 184-word, except in cases of school desegregation. In which, in 1984 and 1986, measures to make put the state on record as being against bilingual ballots and to make English the official language of the state. Once again, all of these pass. It's only the kind of pro-civil rights initiative in 1946 that fails. They all passed by a wide majority. Again, as California is in the midst, this is a period of dramatic economic expansion, opportunity. This is the heyday of California that this happens. I want to, you know, there's something then that might suggest, well, this is the kind of California's past. We have a new electorate. We have a kind of new majorities. And so while it's a sad tale of the past, it certainly doesn't weigh on our kind of current condition. And I want to just give us a couple of snapshots of maybe where we're at if we talk about kind of race and the California landscape. This is a graph that shows felony narcotic arrests by race and ethnicity from 10 years ago, but it's or even more, 13 years ago. But it reflects actually who's in our prisons today. And we should keep in mind here, so this is African American, Latino, white, and other, that all studies suggest there's no differences across groups by drug use and sales, right? So we actually have deeply, deeply discriminatory and racialized enforcement of these laws. This, you know, I'll just show you two others. These are California counties ranked in the top 20 nationally by rates of disparities in which African Americans are sentenced to prison. So these are of the 198 largest counties. These are where California county lies. The number one county in disparities is San Francisco County. Right. San Mateo is fourth nationally, Alameda is seventh, San Diego is 13th, and 20. Okay, so all of these progressive, you know, in most cases, kind of liberally minded electorates are in fact the sites of the kind of deepest practices of racial subordination domination. And again, the notion somehow that there's not, that African Americans are the only ones using drugs in San Francisco should kind of defy our common sense. Okay, one more. This shows the three strikes law passed in 1994, three strikes inmates in California prisons by race and ethnicity, again, to your left, African Americans, Latinos, whites, and other. So it was passed as a, you know, in some ways, or its impact is a racial law. This shows the race and ethnicity of California Superior Court judges in 1993, and the light blue there represents white. So, you know, from my perspective, if we were to remove the place-based references and I were to tell you this was Johannesburg in 1991, you might, you know, we might kind of shake our heads in pity and disgust. And yet, this is perhaps a form of what the historian Alexander Saxton described in California as genteel apartheid. I'm going to move through this. Finally, an important thing, there's been human development rankings. These are ways that we can measure well-being by place that aren't just predicated on GDP, right? Kind of one single measure of economic well-being. This has been used internationally for the last 20 years. In the last few years, they've applied these indexes to the U.S. So it's a measure of the combination of health, education, and standard of living broadly to measure well-being. And by one measure, they analyze all 435 congressional districts in the country. If you look at the bottom 7% of that list, you'd find some places that I don't think would surprise many of us. There's a district in Appalachia, in West Virginia, along the Texas border, Alabama and Mississippi. There are stories to be told, I think, about those places, historic stories. California has five in the bottom 7%, including, in the Central Valley, the lowest ranked district in the country. These are places, arguably, where kind of premature, socially produced death is most profound. Southeast LA, District 34, another Central Valley, another district that's entirely in the city of Los Angeles, and then San Bernardino. Okay. Okay? By broad measures, this is where social misery in the country is at its most profound. Okay? The racial demographics of these areas are not all equal, and you know, they're indeed not all people of color. But part of the question this raises, what story do we tell to explain how California is actually overrepresented? You can certainly find districts in the top 5% as well, but you know that California has become a place with these dramatic disparities so close to each other. And I want to wrap up. You know, we've talked about, you know, there's a notion of new majorities that I think Jane will talk about as well. These increases in certainly Latino voters, the electorate today looks much different. But I don't think we should assume that there's any necessary trajectory that that's going to put the state on, given this history. I will say at some point as we go talking, there is, one question that's raised is there's been episodes of new forms of grassroots organizing that have yet to come to a kind of statewide fruition that we might want to keep our eyes on, but they're important for us to think about. But I want to just kind of end with these two quotes. Pat Morrison, noted LA Times columnist several years ago, expressed something that many of us feel and believe about California. She describes as the land of reinvention. She said, California's gift to the world is the gift of reinvention. Here we are all Eves and Adams with no past, no class, no patterns to follow, the only limits the ones of our own making. And, you know, she's, I think, expressing something of a kind of California sensibility about our political culture here. And I want to contrast that with Joan Didion, who reflecting on her childhood in Sacramento and what history meant there, said, "One difference between the West and the South I came to realize was this. In the South, they remained convinced they had bloodied their land with history. In California, we did not believe history could bloody the land or even touch it." And I think those kind of conflicting visions of how we're going to interrogate our history, the way our history weighs down in our current practices, is something we have to come to terms with if the answer is going to be something other than democracy as producing racial subordination. So I just want to kind of start with that.
Good. Jane, why don't you introduce us to that question that Daniel raised about what the changing demographics of the state mean for what our future of politics and the electorate.
Okay. How do you feel about seeing a few more slides? Are you all right with that? Okay. I've got
we're
some.
Nerds. We're happy with
you're policy nerds, right? You love data tables. I won't give you that many. I want to give you some background. I felt that this morning we had this kind of uncomplicated discussion about representation. It was sort of like representation is just what the politicians say, and we all sort of know that isn't right. So I think what I'd like to do is give a little bit of background or think about just, it's not background, it's sort of new ground in as much as what we know now about voters in California. And I want to emphasize that voters, how did I do slideshow? That voters are, thank you, that voters are not the population of this state, and the future of this state is very much in the diversity. Can we switch, please? Is very much in the diversity of its population with respect to race and ethnicity. So this is a presentation I gave just last week at UCLA, but what I wanted to provide for you some background on the demographics of the state of California and then a little bit of information tying back into what Dan was talking about with respect to public attitudes on immigration and policies about belonging. Because after all, citizenship and immigration are about belonging to a political constituency, right? They're about, part of the reason there's such a big fight about immigration is because it's a question of who is allowed to belong, who's allowed to be a part of this. So I'm going to give you a little bit of data from the most recent USC College Los Angeles Times, which I know that Republicans in particular, Meg Whitman's campaign, were unhappy about. In part, it has nothing to do with the Los Angeles Times or USC. It has everything to do with what the voters said. The voters in the various polls that we had done had put Jerry Brown ahead of Meg Whitman by 13 points in October, and that was the source of much consternation on the part of the Republican Party. As it turned out, Meg Whitman was defeated by 13 points. So it's not a question of where the LA Times or USC stands, it's a question of getting the right answer. And with respect to that, let me just give you a little bit of data from what we found about how Californians, and in this case this is registered voters in the state of California, think about immigration policy. But first, let me give you a little background on the partisan landscape of the state. You probably already know this. Of 17 million registered voters, 44% are Democratic. 31% Republican, 20% are in that elusive DTS category. Is anybody in here a DTS voter, a declined estate voter? You are the most sought-after voters because you are... You could swing either way, and as you can see, there's no majority for either.
That's not true.
It actually is true that they do, and I'll show you some data in a moment. They tend to go Democratic, but they have gone either way, and you can see them going either way. They're not as independent as they look, but of the groups that vote, they're more independent. They're more likely to swing by candidate from election to election. What we see is DTS voters leaning Democratic and the Republican share of voters decreasing. And this has been going down over time significantly. The two groups that are increasing in size are Democrats as well as declined estate voters. Okay. Now, look here at this table, which provides for you in the middle column the population of the state. And this is the whole state. This isn't just voters. This isn't just adults. This is the population of the state according to census data. And the voting population with respect to racial and ethnic categorization. So non-Hispanic whites, while making up 42% of the population of the state, of all the people, make up 64% of the voting population. Someone said 70 this morning. It's actually 64. And if you look at the Latino and Asian American categories combined, 37 and 13 make up 50% of the state's population. So of significant note here, is that Asian Americans are now larger than African Americans. And as some indication to you, when we attempted to get funding to do this study with the Los Angeles Times in order to supplement, augment the size of our ethnic minority voting populations, we could not get a funder to fund the African American group. And in part, it's because this is getting to be a smaller and smaller group, not as a function of the actual size of the group, but as a function of the growth of the other sizes of the population. You'll see that despite being 37% of the population of the state, Latinos make up only 21% of its voting population, and about half of the proportion of Asian Americans in the state, only about half of those turn out to vote.
When you say voting population, are you talking about
registered voters?
Not eligible voters.
That's right. Thank you for that distinction. Yes, this is a voting population of registered voters. Okay.
And can I ask a question?
Yes.
Population this morning's conversation, it's a data question only. Is that legal residents, or is that
it's based on current population survey and American Community Survey data, which is residents. This is not, because we actually don't know. We don't know what the right answer to that. Nobody knows what the answer to that is. Okay. So just to give you a sense, if you're wondering what is the direction of the state, this first one gives you a pretty good sense of it, right? The direction of the state is quickly, rapidly moving away from the sort of the demography of the state that held pretty constant from the 50s on through until like about the 1990s, right? The voting population looks like the population of the state probably 25 years ago. But what you're also seeing when you look across each one of these groups, what is the partisan distribution or makeup here? What you see are African Americans being the strongest Democrats, right? They're the strongest, the most significant Democrats. Only 6% of African Americans call themselves Republicans. And by the 232, that's just a survey researcher's term for when you ask people questions, who do you feel closer to, the Republican or the Democratic Party? Two indicates strongly and somewhat strongly. Three indicates I only lean one way or another. I'm mostly an independent. And the other two goes toward Republican. You'll also see that white voters, and this is of registered voters in the state, are very evenly split, right? They're completely evenly split between the Republican and the Democratic Party, with a quarter saying that they're independent. This is in distinction to party registration, which is Republican, Democrat, DTS. This is on a question on self-identification. Latinos are much more Democratic than they are Republican, but not as much as African Americans. Asian Americans lean Democratic, but a third of Asian Americans call themselves independent. So if you are where's that guy from the Republican Party? If you are a party operative, you want to go after groups that have high proportions in the independent category, particularly immigrant groups, because they're the ones you can still get. So what we did was we asked six questions on immigration policy, some of them related in particular to ones that have already been on the ballot before, right? Most of these won't appear on the ballot in California as initiatives, they probably wouldn't in as much as they are about federal policy, such as a path to citizenship or a temporary worker program. The federal government, as you know, on the basis of Chinese exclusion cases in the 19th century, has plenary power to regulate the entry of immigrants. Abode policies, on the other hand, for example, sanctuary cities or driver's licenses, those are all those are entry policies. Abode policies, on the other hand, are things that can that are controlled by states and municipalities. What do we see here in terms of partisan identification? We asked six questions, and I'll show them to you one by one if you're interested. We asked about the DREAM Act. We asked about a path to citizenship, temporary worker program, reduced time to petition for, to bring your relatives here, find employers, and a 187-style proposal. And I've separated these here by partisan identification. Let's look at the first one. DREAM Act is supported by an overwhelming proportion of California registered voters. More than two-thirds of Republican registered voters support the DREAM Act, and similarly, 42% support a policy of a path to citizenship. This is very inconsistent with the positions that were run by the Republican candidates at the top of the ticket in California, and that included Meg Whitman as well as Carly Fiorina. And this was the basis of my question to the Republican Party chairman this morning about, you know, what is the nature of representation when we think about how candidates are running and how well that matches public opinion. So basically what we see here is what Democrats favoring progressive immigration policies, Republicans favoring some progressive policies, and in particular the very last line, no social services, a 187 style is supported by 59% of Republicans, but also 31% of Democrats. Yes?
Almost the strangest thing to me is that 80% of Republicans profess to favor finding employers for hiring illegals, and yet it's the Republicans at the Senate that filibuster that part of the most recent immigration reform. So they seem to be going against their own desires.
Well, and remember that what these data are from ordinary people, regular voters, as distinctive from the national landscape. California, as you all know, and experienced in the 2010 election, is very distinctive with respect to the rest of the nation. An oddball, they say.
And also Republicans, I like to joke, the Democrats are divided internally about immigration issues within people. Republicans are divided between people within the party, between the people who hire the undocumented and the people who don't want them here. So.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And you can dig a little bit deeper. So if what we wanted to do was think about just partisanship, would partisanship help us to explain fully where we would be on policies that are either exclusionary or more inclusionary with respect to citizenship, who belongs, who is allowed to be a democratic citizen. Partisanship doesn't get you all the way there, and that's why I gave you this data on the voting population. Over time, and as ballot propositions or legislation is raised in the State House and elsewhere, some of this is also influenced by racial and ethnic background. And so the text of the question is underneath. I'm just going to take you through the six questions. We don't have to spend a lot of time on them, but I'm going to take you through the six questions so you can understand the wording of the items and whether when we use the word illegal. The word illegal is used in here often, and it's used in here because it is how these policies are described to people. And so when you use the word illegal, what often happens is it triggers, especially in a survey research context, it triggers the negativity. Having said that, when we use this question, And we do use the word illegal here. This is a typical DREAM Act question. You can see the extremely high support among African Americans and Latinos, also high among whites. 75% of whites approve of the DREAM Act. 71% of Asian Americans, a slightly smaller group. Across the board, in terms of race and ethnicity, California voters are in support of the DREAM Act. With respect to a path to citizenship, and here again, we have used the phrase immigrants living in the U.S. without legal authorization. Here again, what you'll see is a high proportion of both Latinos and African Americans in support, but a very tepid support among both Asian Americans and white voters. Temporary worker program, interestingly, we have high support even among Latinos. Right. So to the extent that we think about temporary worker programs as potentially creating a two-tier status of you know, people who are worthy to be let in to stay and people who are only worthy here to work and then go home, we still see a relatively high proportion, a surprisingly high proportion of Latinos who say they would support this policy. Reduce time to petition by race, ethnicity. Who are the two highest categories here? Latinos and Asian Americans, because these are the categories, primarily heavily immigrant populations. Asian Americans in California, about 75% of Asian Americans in California are foreign born. Okay, so what you have are, and in terms of Latinos, in terms of the voting population, it's less than a third, but it's about a third. So what you have here are people who want and need to bring their own families, and they support this kind of a policy. Interestingly, African Americans and whites are very similar here on this one. More than likely, 90% or more, not immigrant, U.S. born. Finding employers by race and ethnicity, I think one of the most interesting things here is African Americans being the most supportive of a policy to find employers, and I don't have an answer for why this is the case. Perhaps we can discuss this. Finally, I think one of the most alarming is particularly when put within the context of including the information on DREAM Act and Path to Citizenship, that you find as high of a degree of support in the voting population. How can people be in support of the DREAM Act and a path to citizenship, but also be in favor of a 187-style policy? What you see here is the group that is most supportive are Asian Americans of a 187-style policy. This is among the first findings that we have on this policy. We can discuss some of the reasons for that. I should just let you know that one of the things that, and I'm actually finished with this part, one of the things I want to emphasize when we think about discussing and understanding what the significance of a diversified population is when we talk about that diversified population and when we think about trying to understand what their attitudes are, we have to be mindful of how we ask them. So in most polls and surveys are done with interviewers over the phone. Have any of you ever been called for a poll? Have you done it? All right. Okay, because that's good for our response rates. But ordinarily, does anybody have English as a second language? Not here, probably not at this conference. But and if you did, you would be asked to, in English, wait, someone will call you back. And so what ends up happening is if you imagine that 75% of voters who are Asian American in California speak English as a second language, this is difficult, right? We're probably not going to get the right sample by talking to English only. On the other hand, if you speak Spanish, you will be called back eventually, but it's very unlikely that you'll be reached and recorded. And as a result, what the USC College Los Angeles Times poll did is when we interviewed Latino respondents, we interviewed every person that we could identify as a high probability Latino respondent with a bilingual interviewer. So that interviewer could go back and forth between Spanish and English. And what ended up happening is we got a much better and representative sample of Latinos. And when we did our Asian American voters that I show you here, we interviewed them in English, if they wanted, in Cantonese, Mandarin, Korean, Vietnamese, and Tagalog. And so they were able to be interviewed in their own language. We had a relatively high response rate, and we think better data as a function of that. So by giving you this information, I think one of the things I want to emphasize when we think about how to think about political representation, whether it's on issues, questions of citizenship and belonging, or any other kinds of policies, we have to be mindful of not only including those populations in our discussions of what policy perspectives are, but also mindful of the ways in which we gather information about them. So, that's all I have.
Let me ask, try to do a little, see if we can do a little synthesis here. This morning at the plenary, there was a lot of talk about education for democracy, about how it is that people get the information and understanding to fully participate in society. And that particularly goes to the question you raised, Jane, about belonging, because for new communities coming into the United States, finding a way to belong to the larger society is part of the role that politics has played throughout our history. In the 19th century, it was I would argue, somewhat easier, as the earlier panel pointed out here today, that in many parts of the country, immigrants, non-citizen immigrants, could vote in state and local elections, and they came to participate. We had much higher levels of political participation, voting turnouts in the 19th century. You know, we had large political, urban political machines in which the parties played a major role in actually helping assimilate and acculturate people. In California in particular, we broke down many of those structures during the Progressive Era. We have a very weak party system. So what role does this politics play in California in helping people come to belong, and what impediments are there to engaging Californians, and particularly new Californians, you know, in public life and civic culture?
So maybe I'll just try, you know, some historic perspective on this. So just to go back to 1964, there's a fair housing, anti-fair housing measure on the ballot. And if you look at all the kind of voter communications, they'll say something like, Californians should have freedom of choice, or get back your rights. So in that construction, I mean, these are times of deep, deep segregation. I mean, the number of black families that could move into the San Fernando Valley in the 60s, you can count on, you know, maybe two hands. I mean, deep, deep forms of Jim Crow subordination. But that notion of Californians should have freedom of choice is a racial construction, because they're not talking about all Californians. You would have to be white to recognize that as a freedom. Similarly, get back your rights. It's a right to discriminate that they're talking about. It's a racial right. When they say, Proposition 187 was called Save Our State, right? So I think one legacy of that is there's constructions of who the people are, who can legitimately participate in California politics, who has agency, who can be recognized. So if we think about, you know, garment workers within a half mile of us here, people at the LA County Jail, right? Students in Garfield High School who are in a high school built for 2,000 and have some 5,000 students. Historically, they haven't even been recognized as subjects of California politics. They're certainly objects. They're objects that democracy is to solve, but not subjects. So I think there's one that's the kind of how are people engaged in very material, practical ways, the practices of democracy. But I think there's all the broader question of who's a Californian and who's, you know, gets to count and gets recognized in that. And my perspective is, until that's disrupted about who kind of counts as a Californian, it's, you know, the incorporation is marginal, kind of at best.
No. Don't have anything to add? Okay.
Excuse me, I'm Hannah McLaren with the Los Angeles Coalition of Essential Schools. And the thought that I wanted to pose was from a historical perspective that looked at a time when we ceased being citizens and we became consumers. And that, in a way, was really reflected in the enormous growth of shopping as a leisure activity in malls. And there seemed to be kind of a bread and circuses public overlay that silenced the kind of civic participation that those of us of a certain, slightly older generation are well remember. And I don't know if that's been factored into your considerations of this.
That's a great question. And has anybody read anything by a man named Herbert Marcuse? Does anybody know Herbert Marcuse? Yes? Okay, so Marcuse wrote, I think what's interesting about this notion of a consumer society then moving on into politics is Marcuse's notion. He was a critical theorist, right? So the point of the critical, the Frankfurt School, which is, a bunch of essentially Marxist philosophers who wanted us to think about society not as in a critical way, meaning, is this the best we can do? What else can we do to make it better? What is problematic about what we see? One of his most famous books is called One Dimensional Society, where he makes very, I think, persuasive argument that we think we have all kinds of choices. We have tons of choices. Anybody look for black shoes? Like, aren't we all on the search for the, I mean, ladies at least, you're on the search for those perfect black shoes, and you go to 20 stores, and they're all the same. So this year it happened to be Gladiator sandals or something. You know, so every single store carries Gladiator sandals, and we think we have a choice, but how much of a choice do we have? Now, that's a very specific market-based argument, but Mark Hughes's argument is that we, as a capitalist society, what we have is too much production and not enough demand. And so society needs to make us think that we need more to be happy. If I just bought the perfect pair of shoes, I would be blissful, right? And it actually doesn't turn out to be that way. And what ends up happening as the sort of superstructure of the economic system manages to penetrate the political structure, wherein we don't really have very many choices at all, even politically, and that the way that we view the political system becomes similar to the way that we view any of our other consumer choices. And so is that happening? I don't know. But I think it's worth considering the extent to which the close relationship that we have between our political structure and our economic structure, one in which people, you know, want a quick fix. You know, oh, the economy is terrible. Let's hurry up and fix it. Isn't there something that we can do, when there may be many, many more deeper and underlying reasons why that is the case?
Question. What is your analysis of why we as Californians have this wonderful notion that we've never discriminated, that everything is hunky-dory, that those people in the South and other places were bad people, but we've always been such wonderful people, and we ignore all the things that you've said and a lot of other historical realities? What's happening?
I'd be interested in your perspective on that. I mean, one thing I want to, it seems to me, is if we just go back to the fair housing question again, what I found interesting in doing this research was the realtors who were advocating to essentially make, I mean, you know, Prop 14, make housing discrimination a constitutional right, they kept saying this is not Mississippi. It was first passed in Berkeley, and they said Berkeley is no Mississippi. But their opponents, and this is Pat Brown and the kind of new California liberals, also said that. They said, don't bring Mississippi to California. The notion that California was the first state Supreme Court that legitimated the enforcement of racially restrictive covenants. 75% of Los Angeles, at one point, is covered by covenants. The patterns of segregation are as, you know, sharp as any place in the country. But yet, even Pat Brown was invested in this notion that we are not Mississippi. There's great oral histories after, you know, they were stunned that liberal Californians who had elected Pat Brown would vote 2-1 to make discrimination a constitutionally protected practice. And the campaign manager said, I woke up and said, my God, there is racism in California. And that quote to me spoke to the deep, deep disconnect between, you know, the kind of opinion leaders, even among Democrats, and the lived experiences of people who are crammed into housing. Which is all to say, I think that all of us in some ways have this investment in imagining California as somehow different. It's not simply the people that are trying to kind of disavow that. I think there's something productive about that mythologizing of California that a broad section of us have. And even George Lipsitz, in this, you know, book, well-known kind of anti-racist book, calls 1990s the Mississippification of California with 209. But is there a way for us to think about, California racism as foundational, original, that we don't need to implore this, you know, invoke the South to offer it to stir people's understanding?
One little anecdote to illustrate this: Wilson Riles was the first African American statewide elected official. He was elected state superintendent of schools in 1970. When he was elected, and he moved to Sacramento and wanted to live in my neighborhood, a white attorney needed to buy the house for his family so that they could live in our neighborhood because of the restrictive covenants still.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, when he was at UCLA, couldn't find an apartment in Westwood. He had to go to a fair housing group. Willie Mays, when he came to San Francisco, couldn't find housing. He had to go to a fair housing group. And this is, I agree, it's completely disavowed.
Go ahead.
This is just a theory that I wanted to ask you about. I come from Minnesota, and I noticed that there was a very different attitude towards immigrants in Minnesota and it's a state that was started, it's not that much older than California. And I wondered whether it was because that the pioneers in Minnesota still lived in their minds, they still lived in an America where everybody could have land. And whether that was a factor in people's thinking here, or whether initially in Minnesota, you have such a homogeneity from the start, whereas in California, there's almost the immediate conflict with the Californios, and then the bringing in of Chinese labor. So I wasn't sure whether it's a combination of those things, but I just was curious what your take on that was. And also, I wanted to ask you, just looking to the future, and some of the what we're hearing from Jane, do you see that changing? Because one of the things you didn't even talk about in terms of changing values is like on Prop 8, what would happen with Prop 8 today? I think that would be a very different vote. Mm-hmm. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just the historical, Carrie McWilliams points out that in the 19th century, when new kind of pioneers, white pioneers came expecting their parcel of land, that the railroads and, large agricultural concerns had bought up all the land. And I do think you're getting at something about the California dream as at once, like, deeply needed to embrace and yet very vulnerable, right? Like, I've got my piece and I've got to be vigilant that I'm going to lose it. So, I mean, if we're talking about a certain basis of political culture, I wonder if that's true in these initiatives. I mean, one thing I notice in all of these is these are not ones that simply percolate up from public opinion. Immigration, if you look at 1991 polls, is way, way down in a kind of issue salience. But there's something about a way you can address California voters that say there is a danger out there and you need to be alert to it and respond to it that kind of immediately gets people's attention. That I wonder if in Maine or Minnesota, they're coming for your piece of Maine, doesn't resonate in the same way they're coming for your piece of California. And that's the underlying strain of all of this. If you don't do this, your toehold is going to be gone. And I wonder about that sense of vulnerability as a kind of motive force in California politics.
Just to the question of the homogeneity of Minnesota, I mean, as I understand Minnesota is settled by Scandinavians primarily, right? So
yeah,
Danes...
First.
Okay.
Sorry, we weren't there first, actually. Native Americans were there first.
In much smaller numbers than elsewhere, but at that time, Swedes and Danes were at war with one another, and not at war, but certainly did not shop in the same places, live in the same neighborhoods. They did not consider themselves to be homogeneous in the same way that Koreans and Chinese wouldn't consider themselves to be homogeneous. They're homogenized because they're racialized.
Well, it was more Swedes than Norwegians.
Norwegians. I take it you're Swedish.
No, I'm actually Yankee.
Okay. But I think that one thing that I just wanted to emphasize here, and if you think about, look at Wisconsin. Wisconsin's another interesting example. It's settled primarily by Germans, or even New Jersey or Pennsylvania. All new groups, when they arrive and don't look like they belong, are created as different somehow, right? There's a very famous quote by Benjamin Franklin from 1757 where he goes on this long extended thing about, it's this double tirade about how they'll never fit in, and they speak this.
But this was not actually true in Minnesota. I'm just telling you that. That's actually not true. There was a welcoming, there has been a welcoming throughout history, including from Mexican Americans to what you see the African population. I mean, I'm saying it's really fairly different.
It may be, and
Jewish immigration, all the immigrations, you don't see what you see in California by a long shot.
It may be. Minnesota does have, the city of Minneapolis does have an ordinance where, and it's similar to Pittsburgh and other cities where immigrants are in fact encouraged to come, right? Mm-hmm. And Minnesota is also it's not a sanctuary city, but it's certainly a location where Somalis and Hmong have been settled as refugee populations, which are very different kinds of populations because their relationship to the state is one that is of a sort of client relationship to the state, right? They're being supported by the government in as much as they've been given sanctuary or refuge in the United States, very different from, for example, other populations that have come. But I think the point that I wanted to make was that differentiation by some kind of groupness has always been done, and it's always been done by race and ethnicity, as Dan had mentioned, that 1857 quote from Benjamin Franklin where he talks about how these people will never assimilate, they speak this funny language, they eat this weird food, they practice, you know, an ungodly religion. Who is he talking about? Benjamin Franklin, who's he talking about in 1757?
Germans.
He's talking about Germans,
yeah.
And he calls them these swarthy-skinned people, the Germans. Well, people, like the whitest people on earth, right? But at least as we think about them today, but no, not at all. To Franklin at the time, you know, these were undesirable populations. So with every new set of migrations and movements, and this is not just true for Americans and for Californians or for Mississippians or even Minnesotans, human beings, we differentiate, right? We try to forget what we've done. I mean, how many times have you yelled at your children and said, oh, I didn't do that. No, I'm a good parent, right? And I think it's in part of a general human tendency. If we didn't have that, in some respects, it's not good because we don't face our history. In other respects, it is what we have to do in order to get along. It's what we have to forgive ourselves. We have to, for what we have done, and move forward. I think it is very much a double-edged sword. In one respect, inaccurate, but at the same time, what we need to do in order to move forward.
And I think one point I think that you touched on, Susan, California is different than some other parts because this was first Spanish Empire, then Mexico. So when Anglos came for the gold rush, there was already a society here, and it was already this very diverse place. It was already one of the diverse places because of the Spanish Empire of the Pacific. You know, there were Filipinos and other Asians, and there were, you know, Mexicans.
The point that was made was that with the gold and with the railroads, that land was taken up very quickly. Mm-hmm. By corporate interests, and actually that defines to some extent a difference between just St. Paul and Minnesota, St. Paul and Minneapolis.
Yep.
It's a different culture to those
yep.
two cities because right. for those very forces.
Okay. Yeah, hi, my name is Jeff Pollard. I'm a social studies teacher in Sacramento, California. And my question is, I mean, we can really see that I appreciate this image that we all think that California is this very liberal place, and yet we're passing these oppressive proposition measures over time. And at the same time, I'm wondering if just because our demographic changes, does that necessarily mean that our electorate is going to change? I mean, can you see? I mean, if you look at those demographic numbers, it looks like, well, over time, then this is all going to be done away with as this demographic becomes our electorate. But can we say that? I mean, is it possible that our demographic will change and our electorate will remain fundamentally the same?
Yes.
And comments on that.
With respect to partisanship, or
with respect to how they were vote, yeah, with partisanship and how they were and voter turnout, and the, you know, you're looking at the disproportionate whites are less of the population, but are voting registered voters in much higher numbers. Minorities are larger percentage are not represented in the electorate. So, yes, the demographic might change, but until we mobilize the minority communities to represent themselves fully, we still may have the same ballot measures and things like that. So I was kind of curious to see what your opinion on that was. So yeah, our demographics are changing, but does that mean our electorate will change?
It will. It will take time, but it's a good question. I mean, it's not necessarily the case that, you know, all Latinos, once you're born, you just, I'm a Democrat. You know, it doesn't happen like that. You don't just wake up one day and decide you're going to become a Democrat. There are a number of things going on. And the two most important ones that I want to address are that Latinos aren't Democrats everywhere, okay? In Florida, they're different in Florida, right? Texas is different. New Mexico is different. And they're different because of the historical foundations of Mexicans in those areas. And then with respect to Florida, Cubans in that area, right, who are traditionally Republican and remain so, not to the same degree that they once were, because as the older ones have children and the children are becoming more like everybody else in the sense in Florida, more Democratic. So context makes a big difference. Let me give you an example of Italians in New York. If I were to say, what are Italians politically?
Republican.
You'd be like, they're everything, right? They're everything. So just because you're Latino doesn't mean, you know, something springs forth from your loins that you are a Democrat. You know, it doesn't work that way, right? Democrats, Italians in New York City, and in upstate, become Democrats because they're recruited into parties by Democratic structures. Look at Long Island. Who's, you know, Alphonse D'Amato is one of the most famous conservative Republican senators from the state of New York. He's from Long Island, right? Long Island Italians become Republicans because of party structures in that area. The extent to which party structures mobilize, provide benefits, bring citizens into politics or all people into politics will alter the party structure. So one of them is very significantly has to do with what the parties do, what the political parties do. In California, if Republicans continue to run 187-style policies or candidates that are supportive of that, they will have a very hard time attracting Democrats or attracting Latino voters to vote Republican for the reasons that were enumerated in this morning's panel. That's the first thing, right? Parties matter, location matters, context matters. So it's not a foregone conclusion. Demography is not destiny with respect to that. The second thing is, what do these demographic categories mean anyway? You know, like, who is Latino? Who gets classified as Latino? Hispanic is a category that's invented by the federal government in 1980, right? It's put onto, or earlier than that, the Office of Management and Budget, OMB decides, what is it, OMB Directive 77 or something. Which, what is it?
15.
15, thank you. The history guy. And it establishes this category. The category of Mexican was once a census category. Hindu was a census category at one time. Hebrew was a census category, briefly. Mm-hmm. And so what we have to question is what the categories even mean. You know, I put in one of the slides the multiracial category. The multiracial category is the fastest. If you're teachers, you know what I'm talking about, right? You get in your class, you're like, who are you? You know, you don't know who they are because they're just everything. You know, when my children, my husband is French-Canadian, and they have children, I don't know what they're going to be at that point. What will they classify themselves as? So as we move forward into this electorate, the categories themselves are so much in flux that your question is an important one because it's not clear how and under what circumstances we're going to continue to divide ourselves this way. We do it sometimes for good reasons and often for not very good reasons. And the reason we continue with it is to continue to enforce civil rights policy, right? We need to enforce equal protection, but in so doing, we sometimes recreate boundaries and categories that have all kinds of negative consequences.
The other point about demography is that one of the constants in California life that shaped us is how rapidly the state has grown. Over time. I mean, these massive percentage increases in population through much of our history. I mean, even recently, you know, since Proposition 13 was passed, California's population has grown by the equivalent of the entire state of Texas. And that is now started to slow down. I mean, our rate of population increase, I mean, most new Californians arrive by way of the maternity ward now. It's not net inflow into the state. We are, as one of Jane's colleagues at USC, Dal Myers, points out, we are almost on the verge now of having a homegrown majority of adults in California, which has never been true ever throughout California's history. The majority of voters in the state were born someplace else. And so that I think will change that nature of discussion. Immigration, I think we're just receiving our proportionate share now. It used to be that 30%, as recently as 20 years ago, 30% of immigrants in the country came to California. And now it's about down to about 13 or 14%.
Steve Wardinsky from East LA College. Staying with that topic of immigration and just sort of pointing out, if you've ever read The Grapes of Wrath, you have some sense of what Californians have thought about immigrants,
right?
Not even of color, in the 1920s and 30s. But isn't it true that demographically you can see that Hispanic immigrants, whatever that means, by the second or third generation assimilate into American culture, whatever that means, at the same basic rate that most other immigrant populations do? But in California, due to proximity, we just see so many more first immigration Hispanic immigrants or Latino immigrants that it can be sold that they don't assimilate and have no interest in assimilating. And that can inspire certain parts of the population to say, well, they don't want to assimilate to us, so let's discriminate against them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there we could call both Texas and Florida and even New York as examples where I would argue that empirically you could make the same claims about what's happening in South Texas, in Miami, in New York. I mean, just one interesting about Proposition 187, I found this great quote from the LA Times in the beginning of 1994, before 187 passed, and it said, "This year looks to be a slow year in terms of initiatives. The consultants are leaving town because there's no business. There's this obscure thing called, you know, or it didn't have a number, by these two former Reagan people. It's unlikely to pass, and the Republic, and Pete Wilson had been a strong champion of farm labor policies. There was no sense that there was a natural demographic backlash. And you see the sponsors of 187 debating with each other, how do we get them to take immigration seriously? How do we politicize it? Failing again and again and again. So I want to push back a little bit that these initiatives are simply kind of predictable expressions of just everyday changes in neighborhoods. California has long, you know, histories of kind of demographic innovation that don't always necessarily lead to a 187. So I think we have to look at a certain kind of political culture and process that produces 187 as, you know, in California in ways that it doesn't in Texas, Florida, and other places.
So what do you think that process is?
I think it's in part that kind of deep sense of vulnerability that's so easy to tap into among the California electorate. I think it's, you know, you're always like thinking you're a hair from the dream and, you know, this dystopic place that everyone's, or because, you know, I want to come here, I know that's why everyone is trying to take it away from me. And I just think that that's why. I mean, if you look at the substance of 187, it's actually inane. I mean, that every single school teacher is going to ask for the documents of every student plus their parents, and that they're going to get reported, you know. So there's no one's self-interest, but it can be sold, and it was sold as I'm doing this as a principled thing to save our state. And I think to understand that we can't just look at inflows; we have to look at the institutions and the political culture of the state.
I just wanted to make one comment about the assimilation question. I don't know if you're familiar with the distinction between, you know, straight line assimilation and segmented assimilation. It's okay. It's a long-standing sociological argument about how it happens. Like, so the Italians, the Irish, the Jews, they had this, you know, kind of slow and steady. By the third generation, you ate corned beef on St. Patrick's Day, but all the rest of it's gone, basically. And the reason, and one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the process of assimilation isn't just about the, oops, I mean, you all know this, right? It's not just about the person. But when structures, either in the economy or in politics or in society, are systematically constructed to keep assimilation segmented, in particular citizenship laws or labor practices, then you do face a point at which there's nowhere to go. I mean, even if one wanted to go there, there's, you know, you can't get past it, right? You can't go to college. You can't work with papers. And so as a result, unlike earlier populations, either of Mexicans, which, by the way, we did not have a policy of an immigration policy with any of North America prior to the mid-century, right? We had no policy in North. You could just walk across the border and it would be fine. And in fact, most people did, right? Canadians could come over as much as they wanted, and nobody cared. We had no immigration policy about North America. So at issue here is it's when assimilation is disrupted, it's not necessarily, of course, the at the desire of the person who is in question. It's also what opportunities are available to them.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.